Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
First of all, I'd like to welcome Javier Echave, I think that's right, to Just Not Good Enough. He's on Zoom. He's got a fantastic look of Heathrow Terminal 2 behind him, as I think you can probably see, actually, the people who are listening, if there are any. Just Not Good Enough is the name of the show, and I think it just says everything, and it's particularly in relation to me and how I felt for, I don't know, probably most of my life, actually. But can you just, you've obviously got a history of, or a recent past of mental health awareness and issues that you've been living with and all of that sort of stuff. Can you just spend just a little bit of time introducing yourself as to who you are, why you're here, basically?
Great. Well, it's fantastic to be here. So my name is Javier. I am, among everything, probably I'm a human being as well as you. And I think that sometimes I think that we start with roles and big names, but actually behind those names, there's also a human being. So I'm a human being. I have been living in the UK for many years. I was originally born in Spain. I'm married, father of four beautiful children, which they are quite
energetic. Christ, that keeps you busy.
keeps me busy. And I think in terms of my professional life, I am the chief financial officer of Heathrow Airport. I have been with the company 15 years, and I have been CFO in the company for 7 years. Some of my responsibilities, I'm a member of the board. I chair the investment committee. And therefore, the last few years has been quite challenging in terms of the impact, the catastrophic impact of the pandemic in aviation. But I think that there are many things that actually there are great opportunities, great challenges that I'm really enjoying. Apart from that, I have two other personal passions, well-being and sustainability. So sustainability, I think we work in aviation. I think that is something that I'm really passionate, but I think that we know that aviation, I generally believe aviation is a force for good, but also I think aviation can, and science has demonstrated that that has an impact on planet. And therefore, one of my big passions is how can we protect the benefits of aviation in a world free of carbon? And therefore, I co-chair the European CFO Leadership Network for His Majesty the King. He has a working group called Accounting for Sustainability. And we are working in terms of changing the reporting standards so we can make embed sustainable decision-making in corporates across the UK and globally. And my second passion is well-being. So
can I interrupt you? I'm sorry, I am going to interrupt you, and I mean, it's perfectly okay for you to interrupt me. But I mean, you're a CFO, right? This is not how CFOs talk and behave. I mean, I was a CFO at Superdry, as you may be aware, but this isn't the language of a finance director to talk about well-being and sustainability and all of that sort of stuff. So. You know, why? Why is that now your passion? What about, you know, running the numbers and doing the reporting and telling people they're not performing properly?
Well, I think you know as well as me that I think the CFO role is a fantastic role, probably the best role in the world. But I think it has many different faces and many different dimensions. Obviously, there are a few things that we have to provide for the company. Otherwise, I think we should be fired if we don't do properly. I think we are responsible of running certain processes.
Funnily enough, that's what happened to me. But anyway, that's another story.
We can discuss that.
We'll have a beer over that one, actually.
Keen to hear that. Yeah. But I think that there are a few things that we are accountable for. So we run certain processes. We need to make sure that we collect cash and we pay our suppliers and we pay on time and we bring people on board in an efficient way and we provide assets and we allocate capital effectively and all these things. That's one of our responsibilities, running, being that successful operator. Another responsibility is we are the stewards of the company and making sure that the company is resilient and is protected over the long run. But I believe that those two things are almost the compliance part of the CFO. It's things that if I believe that if I don't do these things right, I deserve to be fired. But I think that there are two other things that I believe that makes the CFO role much more rich and much more interesting, which is about being the strategic partner of the CEO, the executive team, and the board in terms of how we are going to really unlock the value potential of the company. But also being that catalyst of of change. I think I have seen, and I have to admit that I have been certain moments in my career where finance professionals, I think we feel very comfortable sitting on the fence, criticizing other budget owners in the organization.
Yeah,
in terms
easy.
Of saying, you are not doing enough,
yeah,
you are
easy.
Not performing
throw,
well enough.
Throw a few grenades, yeah, quite.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. But I think jumping out of the fence into the bullfight, if I can use that expression, being Spanish myself.
I was going to say that's
into the bull ring. You really have to be in the bull ring, and you have to really be that catalyst of change. And I think that in the world that we are living today, I think that there are a couple of things I have realized over the last 2 years, and it's related with these two big things. I think people and planet. I think one of my biggest discoveries of Heathrow is that I thought that Heathrow was an airport. And many people still believe that Heathrow is an airport, but actually Heathrow is much more than an airport. It's a service company. At the end of the day, our role and our success is not just transactionally move you to point A to point B, but actually is to give you a great experience, to surprise you, to delight you, to make sure that you choose Heathrow next time, to make sure that we are enabling your business, that make sure that airlines actually make money and actually they grow successfully. Make sure that we are employing people in the local community. So we have huge role to play, and that means that we are a service company, and service is provided by people for people. And therefore, when people in an infrastructure business, I think the nature of our activities is assets. Genuinely, one of the things I have learned is that the most critical asset is our people. And one of the things that we are very clear at Heathrow is that with the same strength and discipline that we tracked performance of our escalators and lifts and conveyors and baggage belts, I think we want to really raise the level of strength around our people.
Yeah,
assets,
that's so
themselves.
Just,
well,
can I jump
how
in?
Do you perform better?
Can I jump in here? Because I mean, I listened to the interview I think you did with the Evening Standard. I think that's right.
Yep.
And I thought that was absolutely fascinating, because what you've done is taken the CFO's disciplines and applied it to, want of a better expression, the people that you get connected with. So that's passengers and employees and the wider community and all that sort of stuff. And you've sort of came up with your four things that need to be changed in an organization in order to make that better. So could you just talk to me a bit about that, could you?
Well, I think when I became chair of the well-being leadership team for business in the community, which is this other fantastic organization in the UK, which is about responsible business, I have been chairing that fantastic leadership team for 15 months now. And to be honest, has been an absolute delight for me, because I'm learning from them so much, and I feel so realized working with them. That actually, again, it's connected with this demand almost, or that ambition to really get the best out of people. And I think
defined,
that we live in a world where actually things are moving. And yeah. I think when I became chair of the well-being leadership team, I agree a set of actions, and was exactly about redefining our interaction with people. It's
and redefining what success looks like. I think
exactly.
It's the phrase that you use. And that's the bit that I'd like to explore a bit more, and ditto your sort of four critical pillars that you've elucidated very well on that interview, because it's all connected. It's all like, it's like a platform. It's a strategic platform for change in an organization.
Yeah.
So can we start then with the redefining what success looks like? Because normally for a CFO, success is return on investment, you know, all the things that you've mentioned already, but actually these are very different, aren't they?
Well, I think traditionally, I think CFOs, the definition of success has been very much about boosting profits the next quarter, and how you can extract more pounds in the short term. But actually, the redefinition of success comes from the fact that actually investors globally, especially when it comes to businesses like infrastructure, they are not just looking about next quarter profit; they are looking at sustainable value generation, and therefore, there are certain things about, first of all, over which time horizon you are defining success is not just about next week, but also it's about maintaining that sustainable performance. And I like to always talk about the fable of the golden goose. I think that that farmer that has this golden goose and get excited with getting this golden egg first day, but then the second day gets another one, and then the third day gets another one, and then gets impatient to the point that actually opens the goose to try to extract all the eggs, and suddenly the goose died. And I think that the moral behind that fable is that it's not just about extracting the golden eggs of the company, but also protecting the goose, because without the goose, you cannot sustain that performance. Yeah. And I think that the definition of success comes from that long-term nature, but also comes from the currency that you measure success. I think we live in a world where science has demonstrated the impact of carbon. And for example, in the UK today, net zero has been codified in law.
Yeah.
And therefore, when I look at the valuation of an infrastructure business like Hydro, 97% of the value is underpinned by a single assumption, which is that we are going to be operational beyond 2050. Therefore, becoming net zero is not just, in my view, the right thing to do for the planet and for the people and leave behind a successful generation, but also it's about protecting and future-proofing our business. That's why redefinition of success is about, in my view, different time horizons, different stakeholders, but also different currencies. It's not just traditional sterling pound only.
The sustainability angle, I think I understand that very well, and I think that's an absolute must these days, because people won't use Heathrow unless you are working towards that. But there's one thing about the well-being agenda, yeah. And I know you've done an awful lot about that in your organisation in Heathrow. And I want to go back a bit to when you joined, because you were going through a little bit of a crisis.
Yeah.
At that point, I think you're quoted as saying you had a slight mental break, a small breakdown.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it was small, actually. But anyway, that's by the by. But so you presumably came from your owning company, which is where is it? Ferrovial. They own.
Well, I think. Let me tell you about this.
So yeah. What I want to know. Sorry, I'm interrupting you a lot here. But what I'd like to know is, 2016 was a pivotal yep. year for you. You'd come across from Spain almost at exactly the same time. You'd had this addiction with mobile phone and emails and exercise. And it all happened all at once. And I just wonder, what was going through your mind at that point? And how did all of that feel? And did you feel like you were tipping over the edge and all of that sort of stuff? Because just describe that sort of that period.
Yep. So, a couple of corrections and then background. So okay. I came to the UK in 2008. So I was happily living in the UK, growing. And then in 2016, a few things happened in my life. First is on my personal life, a few things was going on. We were blessed by my second son, Carlos, who is absolutely fantastic, but bless him, what amount of energy. And therefore, we're just exhausted.
Great. Great.
On top of that, less happy things. So, for example, my father was diagnosed terminal cancer that year. And he was given 10 months. And my relationship with him was not good, actually. And therefore, it created this before the diagnosis.
Right. Yeah.
And therefore, suddenly... So that was another important thing impacting me mentally and emotionally. And also was the year when I became CFO.
It's a hell of a pressure on you.
A lot of pressure. And I became CFO very young. And be careful what you wish, because you are willing in terms of saying, I would love to be CFO, I would love to be CFO. But then suddenly you become CFO. It's like, oh, shit.
What the hell do I do? Jesus Christ, I can't stand this. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think it's a combination of effects that actually water start racing, and I was feeling more and more stretched, and it's always a tipping point. I remember, as part of obviously joining the executive team of Hydro, you become a member of the command and control structure. So obviously we are an operational business. Unfortunately, things happen, and therefore when we have operational crisis, we rotate among ourselves to really, if you are in command that day, you are effectively leading the command and control response if something bad were going to happen. And therefore, I was in the process of being trained to do that. And I remember that training was extremely tough. So I remember spending 4 or 5 hours. So my colleagues are brilliant in terms of training you. And we were training a terror attack into the airport and a very complex conflict. And I remember that at the end of that training, after 4 hours, I felt completely drained. completely drained.
Mm-hmm.
But also what I felt was a sense of, I was feeling horrible just thinking about if that event would have been real, what would have been the quality of my decision making and the impact of people on the back of the decisions I could have made.
So you're actually thinking of other people in your head rather than how bad you felt.
I think the sense of guilt
was
eating me.
Yeah.
And I remember that was December 2016. And I remember that I promised to myself that I cannot be again in this out of the energy reserve. Because otherwise, I think that I am in a very dangerous path of in a race between a heart attack, a divorce, losing my children, or making a professional mistake that I might never forgive myself the rest of my life.
What about your
well-being?
You haven't mentioned, you sort of touched on it a little bit, but didn't really mention about your mental health, because all of those things would lead to
exactly
poor mental health, wouldn't it?
So what I realized is that the underlying issue is that I did have anxiety. I didn't recognize it. I didn't want to call it because of the stigma that it still had. But what I had was anxiety. I was not happy with myself. I didn't have the right habits. That was not bringing the best version of myself. You mentioned some of my addictions. So I had a very poor relationship with nutrition. So I think that when
poor
I was nervous, I was not eating well.
Yeah.
I was not eating well, and therefore that it was impacting my sleep. I was addicted to the mobile in terms of waking up and the first thing to see was your mobile and all these interesting notifications. And then you end up reading emails, reading LinkedIn, reading Instagram, reading WhatsApps. And even before leaving bed, you are already pissed off and stressed. And it's like, how is it possible that I haven't even left bed?
It makes you wonder how many people in your type of position are like that. The first thing they do and the last thing they before they go to bed is check their phone, see if there's any emails.
Exactly. And you know, considering that I feel absolutely privileged. So I'm someone who, look, I come from a fantastic background. I have, I'm very lucky in terms of having personal relationships. I have a fantastic wife, a fantastic children, very supportive family, great friends. I live in a country that actually respect my rights. I am male, which unfortunately these days a woman still have a tougher one to deal with. I am straight, therefore my sexuality is not questioned by anyone, and I'm white. And therefore, if all these things, I'm still struggling, imagine someone else who can have more difficult cards to play, because there are still many pockets in the organization that actually they are not as respectful, as supportive, and as society has been with me.
To what extent, sorry Javier, but when you are in that feeling really bad moment, mm-hmm. to what extent, you've listed all the things there that are fantastic in your life, and it's a hell of a list actually, it's great, I'm not quite envious, but to what extent do they sort of blur into the background because you get self-absorbed by your guilt or your shame or your anything else?
Well, I think at the time, on any of them, because I'm sure that you have experience when, I don't know, when you have pain in your body, if you break your arm, the only thing that you are thinking about is about your arm.
Yeah.
You don't think about the great things that you have in your life. Your whole attention, your whole life focus on that pain. And I think with mental health, it's about that. I think suddenly everything is about how bad you amplify the bad things, you can fall into victimization, you feel powerless, you feel that there's a conspiration against you, you feel inadequate, you feel not valued, you feel not listened. And therefore, coming out from those situations, I think you need help. And I think that was my way of coming there. First of all, is to call it out. And second is to seek help. I got fantastic help from a couple of friends and good coaches. And I think they helped me realizing that some of the challenges I was facing was environmental factors, in terms of every single individual going through some of the things I was going on would have faced exactly the same. So it was not something that was inadequate about me, but also recognizing in terms of there are certain things, certain routines that can help to bring the best out of me. And that's where, I don't know, for example, my addiction to the mobile. Well, I bought a fantastic Casio analogic clock that is sitting in my bedroom, and therefore my alarm, because the excuse to have your mobile is because the alarm is set in your phone. Well, what if you decouple and you have an alarm from a clock, and actually you park the phone in another room?
Do you know, it's so easy, isn't it? It's so easy, these things to do.
I did that because, but it needs to come from a realization, which is I stopped trusting myself. We think that goodwill is, or strong will, willpower is going to help us. But actually, I realized that I'm human, and therefore I have moments of weakness, and therefore I don't trust myself. Therefore,
but that's
just
quite
the phone in a different room.
That's quite something to say, isn't it? Because I mean, for a finance director, you know, which is a fairly macho, male dominated, getting less so, but dominated environment, and you know, first in, last out, all that sort of stuff. So then suddenly for you to say, hold on, I'll pull your hand up, I've got a vulnerability here. That's quite something. I can't think of many that would do that.
And to be honest, I think I have been like that myself as well. And I think many times is when you are trying to project. One of the things I learned from my coach is that many times, I think in relationships, what you have in when someone is telling you something, I think that I think it's worthwhile thinking that perhaps what that individual is doing is projecting the relationship with herself or himself. So someone telling you are not good enough could mean that actually I don't think I am good enough, and I'm projecting that pain on you. And I have done that.
Ah, okay. So let me understand that. So if I'm thinking I'm not good enough, right, actually it comes from somebody else who is also feeling not good enough, but they're actually projecting it onto me to make them feel better.
Exactly. So imagine I'm very angry and I'm saying, you are absolutely useless. The lighting in the show is terrible. Everything is bad. And it's not true, actually, with a level of intensity. That is, what is this coming from? Well, it could be simply that I'm projecting on you the anger that I have with me.
That's tantamount to bullying, isn't it? And you must have come across that in your business life, that bullying, macho, assertive, bordering on aggressive behavior.
I do, and I think not necessarily in my business, because I have to say that culturally, I think that I have I'm very lacking. One of the reasons why I have been 15 years working at Hydro is because I am some of the culture, some of the values, some of the temperature in the organization, which very much comes from the top. I think that I have colleagues who are fantastic. I have a great boss. I have a great board, and I think that helps in terms of permeating. Yes, these things could happen, and I think that unfortunately we are not perfect. We are human, but I think more importantly, I think sometimes it's easier to criticize these things around us. But I have been that myself too when I am in my worst version of myself, and therefore sometimes one of the things I have force myself to think is that what's going on through the life of that individual that makes he or she behaving in such a way? Because sometimes I think that I can be that individual, and I have been that individual. I haven't been perfect my entire life. I'm not perfect in my entire life. There has been moments in my life that actually I haven't been proud of the way I have behaved. And I think it's more around the environmental factors that can get the worst out of you, and therefore how it's not just about the individual, but because if there's good intention to change, that's fine, but there's also the environmental factors around that.
And the words that come into my head just as you were speaking were about compassion, empathy, kindness, all of those sorts of things. And just because you work in a pressured environment, and you know, where I'll come back to the bit about whether companies pay lip service to well-being in their organizations or not, but where you are in that sort of environment, it's really hard to be empathetic and compassionate, not only to other people, but to yourself as well.
It is. And I think that I read a while ago a story which I really like, which is, I don't know if you are into gardening.
Yes.
Or do you like plants?
Well, my wife more so than me, actually. But I think labor.
Well, so Let's talk 1 second for gardening. I think the interesting thing with your gardening is that when you are doing gardening, I think effectively what you are dealing is with environmental factors impacting the plant. what's the quality of the light? What's the quality of the soil? Is the plant being attacked by other parasites? And
is it
what's the
wet
level
enough,
of alkalinity and wet enough and all these type of things? But actually, when you are doing gardening, you don't think about how good or bad the plant is. You don't think about it. It's like, come on, plant, get it better, get your house in order.
Do you talk to them?
Yeah, you talk to them, but you don't. You don't. Your first approach to the plant is that if it's not blooming, you don't think about, come on, you're a bad performer. You think more about, well, what's going on here? Perhaps it doesn't have enough light, enough water.
I'm laughing because actually, it's true.
But when it comes to people, you think, well, you are not performing well, clearly. And that's objective and you can measure that. But the first temptation is to think about, well, you are intentionally doing something wrong. There's something wrong about you. You are not good enough, which is the title of the, you are not good enough. Well, first of all, this is not about, I don't think that if you are doing your best, I think that your best is good enough. And second is that I strongly believe that every individual in the right environment can flourish, and in the right environment can be depressed and underperform. Sometimes we don't think enough about the environmental factors impacting the individual.
Yeah, that I'm going to interject slightly because do you remember Fernando Torres, the footballer, who played? He played for Liverpool, didn't he? And he was absolutely fantastic. And then I can't remember where he went. Did he go to Chelsea or something like that?
Yeah.
And he turned into not very good, and everybody thought he's a rubbish player. But that's because the environment that he went from to was completely different.
And, completely.
And it wasn't his fault. He didn't turn into a bad footballer overnight. You know, he was still had all the qualities. It's basically the environment and the structure and the support and the people around him weren't working for him at that moment. And then he went to Atletico, didn't he, I think, as well. And he turned back into the...
And he's massive.
Yeah.
He's massive. And I think, Chas, I think that the powerful thing is that this is not an intuition. So one of the things we have been doing in business in the community is a few months ago we launched a report called Prioritize People, Unlock the Value of a Thriving Workforce. So we work in partnership with the McKinsey Health Institute to quantify what's the business case for well-being in the country.
This is
CFO.
Really interesting. Yeah, this is right up your street, isn't it?
Okay, how much are we talking about here? And I think that the fantastic guys in BATC and McKinsey Health Institute were able to quantify that the impact of poor well-being in the UK is worth between 130 and 370 billion pounds.
I know. It's mind-blowing, these numbers.
Which is equivalent to between 6 to 17% of the GDP.
Yeah.
The UK GDP.
I know. Extraordinary, isn't it?
So, again, there's a whole of... It's a quantifiable value. And when you really look at what's driving that... Half of that is driven by presentism and productivity. In other words, toxic relationships in the workplace. So, and the interesting thing is that when we talk about toxic relationships in the workplace, some of them are unconscious. And therefore, the interesting, and this is probably where I have been very passionate and very grateful in terms of converging my role and my passion, is that actually, getting people in the right frame of mind, in the right environment. The way I always define is if you get people being happy, being themselves, doing what they long, and feeling empowered to grow the career that they want to grow, actually, you have a win-win situation. You can have thriving people, thriving businesses, thriving planet, and thriving UK. And now we have been able to quantify in pounds how much that could be. So I think one of the missions I am now is I am in conversation and I'm getting extraordinary support by CFOs across the UK. Because back to your challenge earlier about the nature of the CFO role, I think CFOs need to be out of the fence rather than blocking mental health and well-being investment. Actually, we have to become the champions of the business, of well-being. Mm. Because if we get thriving people, there's no single better way of unlocking sustainable value generation for our businesses and the UK as a whole.
I completely and utterly agree with that. But there's still a stigma around the individual actually saying, holding their hand up and saying, I've got a problem. You know, and I this is one of my passions, is that if you've got a young person in an organisation who's ambitious, wants to get on, but has a mental health issue, they're forced into this dilemma of do they put their hand up and admit, yes, I've got a problem here, and potentially snooker their career? Or do they suffer in silence? And you mentioned presenteeism and always on, which is obviously what you were feeling as well when you've got your phone in your hand all the time. How can you get people to put their hand up? What are the triggers to enable that to happen, do you think?
Well, I think people need to see that actually the senior people in the organizations are also human. Behind the job title, there's a human being. That's why, although I feel not comfortable talking about my own miseries, my addictions,
no, but you're
my
very good
weaknesses.
At it. No, but you're great at it. And it's I don't judge you because of it. Actually, I admire you.
Which is
usually the result, isn't it? That's usually what happens.
It has taken me a while to accept that at the end of the day, I'm human and I'm not perfect and I'm not seek perfection. Actually, I don't believe in perfection. But actually, having the courage to talk about it, I think it's important not only for me, because I think it helps me in terms of boosting my own personal confidence, but also the impact I can have on others. I think one of the most inspirational people I have read in the 20th century is a gentleman called Spider-Man.
Uh-huh.
And Spider-Man's uncle used to say that with great power comes great responsibility.
That's right, yes.
My challenge always to myself, but also to senior people in the organization, is that the more senior you become, it's true that the role brings you power. So the question becomes, what are you using that power for? Can you use that power to help people who actually environmentally struggling more and actually have fewer levers to really change things? And I think that part of my personal purpose is actually to use the power that comes from my role and the connections I have and the networks and the opportunities like speaking in your show to really raise awareness, but also flag that actually, look, I have had mental health issues myself. And that doesn't mean that I am bad or inadequate. It simply means that I'm human.
Yeah.
But also I think that it's a message of hope in terms of saying, with the right help, with the right support, with the right willingness also, I think, because I think also the individual has a huge role to play, you can come out. And I think the best version of yourself is still to come. So my encouragement always is, well, with great power comes great responsibility. Can we use some of our power to really, in a responsible way, to actually help others that perhaps are struggling more than us?
Are there any members of your executive team that have this similar type issue with as you have, that you know of, or that they've talked about?
I think we have a very open culture at Hydro, and I think that one of the things that one of the corporate habits that we have, which I think is a very healthy habit, is that we start most of our meetings with something called the check-in.
Yeah, I read that. Oh, I heard that. I thought that was fantastic.
So, for example, every executive committee meeting, I think we spend 15 minutes going around the table just checking in, which is like, well, how are you? How are you feel? And we use, in my leadership team, we use something called the mood lift, which goes from -9 to +9.
Yeah.
Because it's a very explicit way in terms of saying, well, today I feel a +3. And the reason for that, it could be as simple as I haven't slept well because I don't know. Yesterday I played tennis and I went to bed agitated and I couldn't. Or there was something in my mind. Or my children woke me up. Or some member of my family is not going through a good time. Or I had a phenomenal crisis with my wife or my partner and I'm not doing my best. And therefore, I think bringing it to life, I think helps in terms of saying, if you find that the relationship today is a bit odd, it's nothing about you, I think it raises awareness and I think it cleans the air significantly. And actually it raises an element of compassion in terms of saying, if you are a bit more grumpy than usual today, well, it's understandable.
Yeah.
And I think that it takes time to really develop that muscle. So obviously the first time that we had a check-in,
everybody was 2, 3, 4.
in the UK, you get expressions like, how are you? Not too bad.
Yeah.
Think about what does not too bad means. Or I'm great, thanks.
Yeah, it's difficult to define it. Yeah,
but you then start developing and and it's about co-creating an environment of psychological safety.
That's a really interesting expression, your psychological safety. But just before we go off this scoring thing, does that culture go all the way down? Do the other members and other teams use that same approach?
They do, and I think that I think the fact that you start from the top and the executive is doing, I do it with my leadership team. I know my leadership team do it with their teams, and I know that in many security briefings in terminals, I think that they do that. But I think it's something that you really need to be proactive and I don't know.
Do you talk about it outside the meeting? Do you talk about what scores you've given? So when it's like you go to your exec and then you go and feedback what's happened to the exec, to your team, do you start with, well, we went around the table and there was a couple of fours this, and I put my hand up and I said I'm minus six. Would you do that?
Well, I think when I'm talking about my own scores, I do that myself, yes. Because I say, yeah, I am today at minus three. Why? Because I'm cross. Because I...
Do you do that to yourself or do you do that verbally? To other people?
No, I do verbally. I share with other people, but I tend to talk only about myself. Obviously, I think that there's an element about respecting to create this psychologically safe environment. You also have to respect trust and confidentiality. If someone tells you that, if you tell me in confidence that you are feeling minus nine because you are deeply depressed, I cannot assume that you are happy to disclose to the rest of the world that you are minus nine. It's for you to give me permission to share, and therefore I only do that if you are happy for me to say that. And I think that that's why I think creating this environment of trust and psychological safety, I think, is important. That's why, for example, things like disclosure and humor, I tend to focus just on myself, because you might have the best of the intention, but you don't know how the other individual might be today, and therefore the same word can be perceived in a very different way. And I think that one of the things I have learned in my life, probably by making many mistakes, is not assume.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop assuming too much.
You used the word permission just a little while ago, and see that for me, I think that's the hardest thing to create. Yeah. If you create that psychological safety zone, for want of a better expression. Yeah. That helps give people permission to feel safe about talking about how they're feeling, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it does. And I think that sometimes these days, when this world that we have today, which is a bit crazy, and there are so many things happening and so much change, I think sometimes there's a confusion between certainty and safety. And I think, for example, we were talking about my personal experiences during the pandemic. It was catastrophic for the airport. We were accumulating massive losses daily, and my responsibility is to really protect the business. So despite the uncertainty, actually what has been one of the most effective, successful and thriving periods of my career. And the reason for that is because myself and my team, rather than, yes, it was a lot of uncertainty, but we felt safe. And we felt safe because we felt supported by our board, we felt supported by our key collaborators, and we did a lot of work to really create an environment of trust by sharing plans, being prepared, having constant communication. But when you feel safe, the chances of a very uncertain environment impacting you are just smaller. And I think that safety and certainty are not necessarily the same thing. And therefore, one of the skills that I think we are pretty strong at Hydro, for example, is that we are very good managing crisis. And the reason for that is because people feel safe in uncertainty.
Yeah.
Rather than falling into panic,
yeah.
They are well-trained, we have good procedures, and they can think and execute cold rather than just going with the flow of the panic. And again, it's a strong management system, but also it's training, it's a culture in terms of saying, well, when crisis hits, it's not the time to innovate, it's the time to execute. But importantly, I think making the individuals generating with a crisis, which is probably the epitome of uncertainty, feeling psychologically safe, that actually we're going to support them.
But that,
we trust them, and we believe that actually they are going to do their very best.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that's key, isn't it? Because in a crisis, behavior generally gets lower and lower in terms of standards. You know, you find people shouting, losing their temper, getting frustrated and all of that sort of stuff. And that undoes the psychologically safe environment that you've tried to create. And I mean, you must at Heathrow, you know, given the exposures that the the whole organization business has. And I'm thinking, you know, terrorism, goodness, and all of those sorts of things. You're right. You're sort of on the edge, aren't you, a little bit, about a crisis that could happen now?
Yeah, but I don't know. For example, I have, unfortunately, probably, I have had few occasions where I have to be a goal commander in crisis in the airport. And many people ask me in terms of, well, what's your role? Well, I think the majority of my role is creating the environment to enable the great team that we have to do their job. We have an extraordinary COO, we have an extraordinary operational team, we have an extraordinary crisis team, we have an extraordinary protocols, processes, discipline, and training. And I think pretty much, I think the role when you are in the middle of the crisis is just protect the team to do what they know to do better than anyone else. And I think it's, and creating that safe environment where actually they can do what they are the very best in the world to do. Mm. And therefore, is that I am doing any activity to really help some of the crisis? No, but then pretty much in terms of containing and creating the safe environment for those extraordinary individuals to do what they do better than anyone else.
How hard
and they feel great doing that.
How hard do you find it is in those circumstances, and maybe you haven't been in a real crisis, but you've certainly trained for it, to not lose your temper?
Well, it's hard, but I think, as everything, I think that I think every skill can be trained. And
empathy? Can empathy be trained?
I think empathy can be trained. Empathy can be trained. I think that the training perhaps is not in a class. Perhaps I think you need to go to do social work in a local community to really understand or develop connections with humans, and there are certain environments that are easier to do that. I genuinely believe that every skill can be learned, and I genuinely believe that everyone can change. I am not the same as yesterday, and I'm not the same as 5 years ago. And I think, still believe that the best version of myself is still to come. But I think that sometimes I think you have to accept that if there's, and it's back to self-empathy. I think accepting that the best version of yourself is to come implies that I am not my very best now.
I really like that.
And accept that and say that without feeling bad or feeling inadequate, I think for me is one of the fundamental skills to develop, which is like, yes, I'm not a final product. I will only be a final product the day I die. Hopefully, it's still many
yeah, well,
years
I don't
away.
Know. If you believe in the afterlife, you've still got a bit to go, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm even several lives away.
You see, I really like that as an expression to because I really struggle with self-empathy and self-help and compassion. Yeah, right? And hence, just not good enough. That's what the show's called, of course.
But Charles, let me tell you one thing. Okay. I think that this is, for example, I think it's connecting with many times. I think corporates, we talk about the definition of leadership. I have grown up in more traditional cultures where people say, well, leaders are those individuals who make people great. I genuinely believe that all of us are absolutely great. You are absolutely great. You were born great. The problem is that shit happens in life, and shit happens to the point that actually you forget, hopefully temporarily, how great you are. And therefore, for me, I think that the definition of leadership I really like is not about making people great, because you were born great. It's about reminding people how great you are and inspiring them to be it. So you are absolutely great, but I'm sure that there has been circumstances in your life that has made you forgetting how great you are. And you have been forgotten for so long to the point that actually you are even questioning if you are great.
Yeah,
I think for me it's about reminding that you are absolutely, absolutely great.
Yeah, you see, I've said this before on this show, but I mean, I went to boarding school and got bullied, right? And yep. So I'm at 13, 14 maybe. And that's not a good time to have that sort of happen to you. Because people are telling you that you're not great all the time, and you know, you suddenly start to believe it. And it takes, well, it's taken me 60 years. And I still haven't got over it, you know, 50
years. But it's back to the flower. Anyone going through the experience that you went would feel in the same way that you feel. So it's not that you are inadequate. It's that actually you had the wrong light, the wrong water, the wrong soil, and therefore temporarily, I think that you behave in what was expected for you in those circumstances.
Do you know what, but, Javier? Do you know what? Sorry to interrupt again. I want to have you alongside me for the rest of my life. The way you're talking is just so inspiring and reassuring, and I think it's absolutely terrific. Terrific. You are to be congratulated.
No, thank you.
I've taken more notes on this than any other one, frankly. Well, I've written all sorts of stuff down.
I genuinely believe that I think we are great. But I think that we have to acknowledge that life can be very tough. And there are circumstances, unfortunately, and the reality is that some of those issues that we all face, so for example, when I was facing anxiety, I think when you really start digging in terms of where is this coming from, actually, I went back 30 years in my life.
Yeah.
And it's those experiences when you are under 20, let's call it that way,
puberty,
that actually
going through
shape
puberty,
you.
Actually, probably going through puberty, I think, is the most difficult period.
Because at the end of the day, I think it comes to simple things like you feeling unconditionally loved. Many times, I think we develop relationships, and although I have fantastic parents, but you get this feeling that actually you're only loved if you score a goal on the Sunday match. You are only loved if you score great marks. You are only loved if you do your best. And therefore, you, in a very early age, you associate, I'm loved if I do this, which means that I am conditionally loved. And then suddenly you spend the rest of your life seeking success on material things to get back that feeling of I'm loved, I'm enough. Why? Because you have achieved the things that you believe that you're going to be loved, rather than just accepting that you have the right to be loved of how you are because you're great. and recognizing that actually you deserve unconditional love. And part of the challenge is recognizing that we should only be surrounded by people that unconditionally love us, and get out from our lives people who don't.
Yeah,
unconditionally
that's quite hard
us.
At work, isn't it? Because
it does.
Because there you don't, you know, that you can't, sometimes you can't get away from these people, and they
well
are,
yes
they are
it,
there.
It does, it does. And I think that sometimes, well, if you have to make, sometimes life puts you into a situation that you have to take compromises, and unfortunately those compromises might be very big and for too long.
Yeah,
because you have to get to the end of the month,
you have
to feed a family, you have to look after people, and therefore you have to do all these things. But I think sometimes it's not just at work. Sometimes I think it's even at home. I think that, and we noticed in the pandemic, I think that it's very interesting that during the pandemic, actually, there are certain statistics that were absolutely horrible. I think that there's a huge proportion of, for example, domestic abuse that happened at home.
Yeah.
And therefore, people were forced to stay 24/7 with their abuser. And therefore, that's hugely challenging.
It's horrific when you think about it, isn't it, actually?
And therefore, you have no other choice. Yeah. And that's why you see mental health and even worse things like suicides has increased significantly during the last few years. But I think it's not just those extreme situations, but also I think it's an element of that in all our lives. And I think that, to be honest, yes, I did have mental health within the spectrum. Actually, probably was not. I bounce back and I learn, and actually, is one of the things, in fact, that I wouldn't have changed in my life, because probably without that experience, I wouldn't have collected some of the wisdom that and the pain, the wisdom came through the pain I went through. And therefore, I wouldn't change those episodes in my life. But I think it's, personally, I think it's important to acknowledge those things. But I think it's back to, we develop these senses of feeling worth, feeling valued, feeling understood since very, very early stages in our life. And again, very early in our life, we forget how great we are. And that's why I think that this process of reminding people how great they are and inspire them to be it can be very hard, because you might have to help uplifting very heavy rocks that has been sitting there for many, many years. But I think it's possible. And I think we should have hope that actually is possible. And for people like you, for example, it's inspiring that you are using your painful personal experiences to actually become a beacon and become a voice for people. The amount of help that you're creating through this show is unbelievable, because people think that a successful individual like you have the courage to talk about these things and actually create a conversation.
Yeah, but
like
I say,
which is helping a lot of people.
And I appreciate that, and thank you for saying it. And you know, if you can help the old adage, if you can help one person, then that's enough. But it's interesting that it took, when I left Superdry in 2012, you know, 4 or 5 years of hell, 5 years of getting better, and here I am now. But it's taken me 10 years after I left work to actually become public and doing the work that I'm doing now, which is such a shame. I mean, it would have been so much better if I didn't get to that point, because there was the right support network like you've got in Heathrow for people to be, to feel loved, to want to use your expression.
Yeah, but again, you can take these things as a negative or as a positive. The reason why it took you so long is because it was very painful, but also because perhaps one of your superpowers is because you are a sensitive individual.
Yeah, I am. I'm overly sensitive, yeah. Yeah.
And that sensitivity actually is your biggest power, but also could be your kryptonite as well. But I think that
you should be a therapist.
It's about recognizing that and using as a power. Otherwise, you wouldn't spend your life these days talking about these conversations and spending your huge talent and your time and your money running this extraordinary show, because you know that you have the ability to really impact people. And I think that it's interesting, because the things that actually are the ones, almost the kryptonite, I think the other side of that is actually our superpowers.
Yeah, there's always two sides, isn't there, to every coin. And unfortunately for me, and I don't want this to be about me because it's about you, but for me, the kryptonite tends to win out more so than the other side, you know, which is just something that I have to live with. But at least I can talk about it publicly, and actually it's therapeutic to talk about it as well. It does make me feel better.
And I think it helps you, but also I think you shouldn't underestimate the impact that you have in your audience.
Thank you. I think that's probably... I'm going to ask you one really naff question, right? Which is what always happens. It's like, say, you know, when a kid meets somebody famous, says, what's your favourite song, or who's your favourite player, right? So what is the best thing you've done at work that's helped move the mental health agenda along? That we could all do, or at least all try to emulate in some way or other. Do you want to come on next week and tell me after you've thought about it?
I think probably one of the most life-changing experiences I have in the workplace is several years ago, we launched a program called Purpose and Values. I think as an organization, we were trying to define our own purpose, why we're in business, and we define it like making every journey better. That's what we do. And behind that is this commitment to services, this commitment to continuous improvement, is this commitment to respect to our passengers and airlines and local communities. But I think we did this training to help everyone in the organization to identify our own purpose. And I think one of the exercises that we did through that training was to identify your values. We did something called the lifeline. If I were going to ask you, what are your core values? Which was the first time I started to define in terms of loyalty and meritocracy and truth and respect and all these type of things. But the second part of the exercise was very good, was what was the experience in your life that make this value so important for you?
Yeah, because that's the bit you never get to, isn't it? I mean, a lot of companies have their list of values and they publish them religiously in their annual report.
Yeah, and it's funny because we went through this exercise. So it's like, well, why loyalty is such an important value for me today? Because there was a moment in my life that I felt hugely betrayed. And going back in time to find that experience, write about that experience, and even more powerful, share that experience in a safe group of 10 people openly. I think all of us were broken in tears talking about our lives. But the interesting thing is that the stories were very similar. Were about experiences with our parents, experiences in the school, some of them much more dramatic in terms of situations of abuse and or loss in lives. But actually, going back in time, identifying the way that you did earlier about this was the experience in my life that actually shape me in a way and has defined the core values I have today. So there are certain things I can tolerate, but there are certain things that I cannot tolerate. You cannot tolerate bullying because of the pain that you went through.
Yeah.
And therefore, yeah, that has developed an extraordinary boldness and extraordinary courage and your ability to speak up when you see certain things. And that comes from that experience. And I think that going through that exercise and sharing what was my core values and where that experience was coming from, for me, it was hugely liberating. I left that training with a huge understanding, a better understanding about myself, a sense of relief, a sense of I felt lighter because I had these unconscious rocks on my shoulders that I was not even aware of some of them. But again, for me, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences I have got at Hydro, and the ability to really have an organization that is prepared to invest in these things, to invest in money, but also invest in time and creating environments where people can talk about that, I think is fantastic. So that's probably the one I would choose.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I mean, I'm sat here feeling actually better having spoken to you, because one of my big values is kindness, right? So, and I'm just not kind to myself. And I think this goes back to the bullying period when I was 14 or whatever, and people were unkind to me. So therefore, I think that is just appalling behavior. I'm not going to let that happen. I'm not going to behave like that. So I now end up trying to be as kind as possible to everybody I can. And even just today, right, coming here on the tube, there was a little girl with two big suitcases, and I'd got a heavy bag on my back, and I said, can I help, you know? And she gave me those two suitcases and I carried them down the stairs, and she said thank you, I said thank you, I said it's no problem, and I went away, and my shoulders were back, my head was higher, I felt instantly better for that little moment that I'd helped somebody. And I think that connection between what your values are and what's driven you to that point helps to, as you use the word, liberate yourself.
Yeah, and I think when you can find a way where you can connect those feelings with the business that you work for example, in my case, which is about servicing passengers, actually it's pretty powerful, because you can have those daily experiences that actually boosted you.
Yeah, just going through Terminal 2 behind you now.
Exactly.
And
helping that little help that guy.
Yeah, help the guy with his suitcase lifting it off. I mean, my God, yes. God, you've got thousands of opportunities. Oh, look, exactly. Javier, I'm being told we've got to wrap it up. Look, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. Thanks ever so much for coming on. I understand you're at the water cooler event. Is that right? Next year?
Yes, correct. October, yeah.
I think I am as well. I haven't been confirmed, with a company called Head Torch, which does a lot of mental health stuff. And I'm the CEO and owner of that is coming on this show in a couple of weeks' time.
Fantastic.
So if that's the case, we must meet up and have a beer, and you can tell me all about
my
values.
Well, I think if
values.
It's not the water cooler, we'll find another opportunity to catch up, because it has been a complete delight. Thank you for the opportunity. And again, thank you for everything you are doing for this show. I think you are making a difference.
And you, for what you're doing for the 75,000 people and 5.5 million people that you live with, deal with in your charity work. So
thank you.
Thanks ever so much.
Keep well.
Yeah, and you. Cheers, Javier.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.